Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And my intro about being the conscience of psychiatry reminds me that there's more than one conscience of psychiatry. And I'll be introducing you to another in a few seconds. Do not forget that this Saturday, October 26th, I'm going to be in the New York City area talking at Wagner College at the conference on R.D. Lang in the 21st century. To get more information, that's on Staten Island, New York. To get more information about the conference, which goes Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, just Google R.D. Lang. That's L-A-I-N-G in the 21st century. I'll be there at 2 o'clock. But it's a good conference in general, and I hope to see folks there. I haven't been to New York City and that environment for a long time and don't have any immediate plans to return soon after this Saturday. Well, my guest today is psychiatrist Joanna Moncrief. Joanna, are you there?
I'm here, Peter. Yep. Can you hear me?
I can hear you good. Joanne is coming from Great Britain, which I thank her for a great deal. Joanne is the author of The Myth of the Chemical Cure, a very good book, and now this year, The Bitterest Pill, which focuses on antipsychotic drugs but will give you a huge insight into the whole problem of psychiatry, the history of psychiatry, and the latest critique of psychiatry. She's a very active member of the Critical Psychiatry Network in Great Britain. She's a senior lecturer in psychiatry, the University College in London, and she, that's right, it is still in London, right?
Yes, I'm still in London, yep, at University College.
Senior
London.
Lecturer. And yep. She's a consultant psychiatrist, which means that she's in the healthcare system and has a practice. Is that right? I think that's what that means, Joanna.
I work in the National Health Service.
Service, yes.
Yeah, I'm covering a patch of London.
A patch of London. We have no such expression in the English language, at least in America, a patch of London. I love Joanna Moncrief. I've known Joanna for many years. We have on very rare occasion gotten to be together. We talked on the phone the other night and just had a lovely time. This is your second time on the show, I think. Is that right?
Yes, it is. Yes, we had a nice chat about a year ago or a couple of years ago, I think. Yep.
Joanna is a very brave, honest, direct human being. One of her latest articles has a sentence in it that I'm going to quote for you, a concluding sentence of, "Hence, psychiatric diagnosis functions as a political device employed to legitimate activities that might otherwise be contested." Just a historical note on that. The whole idea of civil commitment from several hundred years ago, beginning in, France, is about bypassing the usual protections under the criminal law so that medical physicians, who became known as psychiatrists, could lock up people against their will without the usual protections. And I think, I don't know if Joanna is specifically talking about that, but psychiatry does indeed function as a political device that allows activities to look legitimate that might, as she puts it in her subtle way, might otherwise be contested. Welcome to do the show. Well,
yes, thank you, Peter. I mean, on that note, of course, now psychiatric control extends out of the hospital, doesn't it, with community treatment orders. So it's not just about putting people in hospital who are behaving in inconvenient or antisocial ways, without, as you say, the protections that people would get if they were coming under the criminal law. It's also about what controlling what people do outside hospital.
Yeah, it's like we are turning our countries, our societies into mental hospitals and doing things like committing people to treatment against their will, even while they live at home, screening in schools, and so on, really.
That's right. The sort of medical gaze, the psychiatric gaze is stretching further and further out, isn't it, into the community and infiltrating into all sorts of areas and affecting people who are actually well. This is what I think is the real problem with community treatment orders, that people can be forced to take medication when they're actually perfectly well. You know, they're well enough to live in their own homes. They're not in hospital, but they can still be told you must take this treatment because we, you know, are saying you must not relapse.
Now, under a national healthcare system, I think that probably gets even more menacing, and that we're moving in that direction. We're going to have in this country record systems that are going to be sent to central areas around the country. Doctors will have access to them, probably with nothing more than your Social Security number. Is that going on in Great Britain, so that if you get one of these community, I'm not sure what you were calling it, but one of these community incarcerations, really, that everybody's going to know about. It's going to be in your health record.
Well, we probably share health records more than you do anyway, whether someone's on a community treatment order or not. But if someone's on a community treatment order, it would apply wherever they were in England anyway.
Yeah, see, here it's still in the States, because not every state has this. But with Obamacare, these things are all going to become universal like they are in Great Britain. Now a person can leave a state and get away from forced treatment. In Great Britain, you'd have to leave the country, it sounds like.
Yes, that's right,
Wow, I hadn't expected to start off with this, but this is it's just such a terrible state of affairs.
It's psychiatry, doesn't it, I feel, this issue of coercion and, you know, the use of drugs to change people's behaviour, which you've written about for such a long time, and which I think psychiatry it remains ashamed about and isn't really prepared to face up to a lot of the time. And yet we have to, because that's what, as I say, that's what I think is really at the heart of it still.
Well, psychiatry pushes for it in this country, and I'm sure in yours. Psychiatry has always taken as much power as it can get. It's an interesting phenomenon. I guess that's true of most people and most institutions, but psychiatry has such vague and huge power. I mean, the criteria for its exertion are so vague, and yet the power is so great. And psychiatry has always aggrandized itself.
Yes, I suppose. Psychiatry has needed to carve out a niche for itself, hasn't it, and wanted to medicalize this area of social control in order to justify its existence. I've been trying to think about social control recently and, you know, face up to it, because it's a part of my day-to-day life as a psychiatrist in as an NHS psychiatrist in London. You know, I do have people who I feel have to go into hospital. I feel that, you know, they're very disturbed, and sometimes they're dangerous, and sometimes I think it's right that someone is taken into hospital even if they don't want to go. So I've been trying to think about, you know, what controls could be put on that process that would make it transparent. And the first thing, I think, is to acknowledge that this is a process of social control, that it is about, you know, society's discomfort at the way that someone is behaving and how society deals with that. And I think we need to have more you know, more legal process around the process of admission to hospital to make sure that people get a fair deal, make sure that those decisions are properly and independently made and scrutinized. Because I think they, you know, I think there are circumstances where that has to happen. I don't know whether you would agree. Would you agree with that, Peter?
No, not at all. As probably most of my listeners know, but I need to clarify that. No, since I went into practice in 1968, I swore that I would never participate in locking up someone against their will as a psychiatrist for any purpose. And I haven't done so since then. On a rare occasion, maybe twice in my career, one of my patients has gotten locked up by somebody else because they were being a menace on the streets. But my feeling is that under our Constitution, and I was in the United States, there is no provision for locking up people outside the criminal justice system with all its protections, and that it's unconstitutional, according to the Bill of Rights, to do this. There's just no provision for it without the commission of a crime. But the mere assessment of dangerousness by another person, or the mere assessment that this individual is a menace to themselves, should not be sufficient. So I haven't participated in that, and I've never had a patient commit suicide, and I've never had a patient commit violence under my care. I think it's partly because I don't do those things. I have to do it, and I don't medicate them either, so I have to engage them. But I respect you so much, Joanna Moncrief, that I'm just glad to have an open discussion about this with you.
Well, yes, I mean, I deal with a lot of people who do have some quite serious psychotic breakdowns, and I think sometimes they need containment somewhere. And I work a lot with service users in the UK, and most of them, I think, would acknowledge that, you know, some people from time to time need that sort of containment, as well as, you know, wanting different sorts of help and wanting more understanding and support, which I think is where you're coming from, and, you know, wanting someone to try and help them get over their problems or come to learn to manage their problems in the long term rather than just having to have breakdowns and be locked up.
Well, you know, one of my by the way, this is an interesting conversation, and it might make you a little safer in Great Britain because it'll be so clear that I'm even more dangerous than you are in my views. So they might just sort of relax about you a little bit. No, I believe that the fact that service users, which is, folks, the British term for what we call consumers, if we're taking the government's viewpoint, or inmates or ex-patients or the Madness Network people. I think that one of the problems of so-called service users is that they want to use these services, which are not good, the drugs and the hospitals. And I would no more base my ethics on the service users wanting to be involuntarily hospitalized sometimes or to have their friends involved than I would on a slave, a freed slave, wishing at times to return to slavery.
I think that's a good point, Peter. I mean, if we would agree, say, something like ECT, there are some patients who, I'll go back to patients because I think it's clearer, but I think it's just more standard, but it doesn't necessarily imply that I go along with all the baggage. But some patients want ECT. I feel that ECT is not good for anyone because, you know, as your work has shown and other work has shown, it seems to me that if it's doing anything, if it's working in any way, it's working by damaging the brain in some way, maybe just temporarily, but still causing some damage and disruption. And I don't think that can be good for anyone. So even if someone really wanted it, I would, you know, be very, you know, not feel that that was the right thing to do. And the same with drug treatment sometimes as well. Not always. Sometimes I think people, you know, can make perfectly sensible decisions about drugs. about drug treatment too. So yes, I take your point. We have to decide what, you know, I think as a society we have to decide what the right sort of approach is to all the problems that we currently label as mental illness.
I was telling folks, I was telling Joanne on our phone call that in regard to ECT, I want to remind folks that I do have a free website that is the source for information on brain damaging effects of shock treatment, which I am certain are permanent in almost every case. It's just a matter of degree. And the website is ectresources.org, ectresources.org. Now, Joanna, you have been writing now about the long-term damage from the antipsychotic drugs, and you're kind enough in your book and brave enough in your book to cite my early work going back a couple of decades on that. What is your feeling now that, you know, as a psychiatrist who is a bit more moderate than I am in some ways and works in the system, about this whole issue of the antipsychotic drugs, now that we're getting more and more evidence for my original observations in a couple of scientific papers they're causing permanent brain damage. What's your sense about this and what we should do?
I think it's a very, very difficult, very hot issue. I think mainstream psychiatry hasn't really begun to get its head around it yet, although certainly there's an awareness that this research exists. You were talking about this way back in the 1980s, weren't you, Peter? And I, as a very young psychiatrist, I read Toxic Psychiatry, one of your early books, and I remember thinking, this is very interesting, but this is a bit extreme. Surely the drugs can't be that bad.
Yeah, right.
And you have been completely vindicated. You know, more and more evidence has come out over the last 10 years, which is showing, is building up a picture that long-term antipsychotic drug treatment does indeed shrink the size of the brain, increase the size of the brain cavities, the brain ventricles. We don't yet know definitely, you know, what significance that has, but coupled with the fact that we know these drugs cause tardive dyskinesia, that tardive dyskinesia is a neurological syndrome which is often permanent, irreversible, which includes, you know, damage to the movement centers, but also seems to involve often some intellectual effects as well. You know, we have to be worried about this evidence. And I think patients are worried. You know, people read the internet and are aware of this information, and people are rightly, I think, becoming even more worried about the long-term effects of these drugs. I think it really changes the way that we should be using these drugs, the way that we should be behaving as psychiatrists. I think that we should be focusing on short-term treatment if people need it. Well, the first thing that we should be trying to do is trying to avoid the use of antipsychotics if possible. If it's not possible and someone really is very disturbed and, you know, the drugs are the only thing that's going to bring them out of that state, then they have a short course of antipsychotic treatment. And then I think you've got to try and get people off them, try and get most people off them anyway. Doing that slowly and gradually, as I'm sure you would support, you know, to make sure that people don't have withdrawal-related effects, and supporting people through that process. And if it doesn't work the first time and people have a relapse or another episode, then I think, you know, we've got to be encouraging people to try again, to try and get off their drugs again in a supported and gradual way. I think this evidence does make the case against antipsychotics really very strong, so that although I wouldn't say that we should throw them out altogether, because I think that they can be useful when people are really severely psychotic, I think, you know, they've got to be a last resort and we've got to be helping people to get off them if they possibly can.
So what would you think? My own view would be that if these drugs were being given to anybody except mental patients, they would have actually been jerked off the market a long time ago, between tardive dyskinesia, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, the metabolic syndrome, which leads to early death with cardiac disease and diabetes and elevated lipids in the blood. I think if these drugs were being given to anybody but mental patients, and if they weren't making billions of dollars, I think they would be off the market, and conventional psychiatry even would be doing something different. I think if you look at the studies and you want to quiet somebody down, there's no great advantage to using the antipsychotics versus quieting them down with benzos in a hospital where it's controlled and where it's not going to be long-term.
Yeah.
But
I absolutely support that. I think that, you know, first that ought to be done before, as I say, I think antipsychotics ought to be a last resort, and the first thing to do would be contain someone, support someone in hospital if necessary, and benzodiazepines. I agree. But then I would say that if, you know, if that doesn't work and someone is still very disturbed and they're not showing any signs of recovery, then it might be excusable to use antipsychotics. I agree with you. They're really toxic substances. They have lots of very, very dangerous side effects like the ones you've mentioned. They're also extremely unpleasant to take, as I know you are well aware, because I quote lots of people that you quote. In your writing, you know, this dampening effect they have, this emotional suppression that they cause, people really find that they've lost their personality, lost themselves, lost their initiative, their creativity, their libido, their sexuality. You know, all the things that make us human are being damped down by these drugs. So they're really not things that people would generally want to take, and are not things that people should be taking if there are other options.
When we were talking on the phone, you brought up the Danish study. Tell folks about that.
The Dutch study.
Dutch.
Yes, yes.
It's all the same to an American.
This is a very interesting study, and I think coupled with the recent evidence on brain shrinkage from the brain imaging studies, this is what really means that our approach to use of antipsychotics has to change radically. The Dutch study was a study of people who'd had a first episode of psychosis, a first breakdown. And what it did is it took people and randomized them either to carry on their antipsychotic treatment or to go into a group which would have a gradual and supported reduction and, if possible, discontinuation of the antipsychotics. They followed people up at 18 months, and in line with other studies, most other studies, the group who'd been in the discontinuation group had a slightly higher rate of relapses. Relapses weren't high in either group, but they were about twice as high in the group who had had the discontinuation regime. Then they followed people up 7 years later, and after 7 years, first of all, what had happened is the relapses had equalized. So the people in the long-term, people who'd stayed on long-term treatment had had as many relapses by 7 years as the people who'd been in the discontinuation group. But the people who'd been in the discontinuation group were functioning twice as better, were twice as likely to show recovery of social functioning than the group who'd gone on long-term treatment. And this study is important because it was randomized. So you can't criticize it by saying, oh, well, the people who got off their drugs were just the people who would have done better anyway. That's been the criticism of other cohort studies, long-term studies that have followed people up. And those studies also, by the way, find that people who don't take drug treatment or don't take it for quite long periods tend to do better than people who do. As I say, they were criticized because people just said, oh, well, that's just, you know, the people who don't take the drug treatment are the people who would do better anyway. You can't criticize this Dutch study for that because it was randomized. Not everyone in the discontinuation group came off their antipsychotics. In fact, only about 20% came off the antipsychotics completely, and a rather larger number reduced their dose quite substantially, got down to just using, you know, very small doses, either daily or just, you know, a couple of doses a week or a month or something like that. And if you looked at people who'd got off their drugs completely, and people who were taking very low doses, they were doing better than people who were carrying on long-term treatment. But the group who were randomized to the discontinuation group were doing much better, and that's the really significant finding. So it says, I think that study tells us that, you know, there are some people who can get off their antipsychotic medication, and overall, if you try and take people off, they won't do worse in the long term, and they will do a bit. They won't do worse in terms of relapses in the long term, but they will do a bit better in terms of social functioning. So I think this. I think the study, again, like the studies on brain imaging, shows that we've got to have a different approach to antipsychotics. We can't have the blanket approach that, you know, long-term treatment is the right treatment for everyone. We've got to actually be, as I said, trying to avoid these drugs if possible, and if people are on them, trying to help people to get off in a supported and gradual and flexible way.
When we talked on the phone, I didn't ask you to be prepared to give scientific analyses of recent studies, so I don't want to put you under too much pressure, but the kind of data you bring forward is similar to the kind of data I like to bring forward. I think it's good for people to hear it from someone else other than me. Would you, we're going to break in about 3 minutes, would you talk a little bit about the MRI studies now that are so consistently showing, even after relatively short-term exposure to antipsychotic drugs, that there is brain shrinkage. And by the way, folks, brain shrinkage basically goes along with dementia. Dementia, the very diagnosis of it, where you're losing generalized brain function, overall brain function, like Alzheimer's, or the results of constant blows on the head, concussive exposures in football can produce similar things in boxing. This involves cell death, and there's a correspondence directly between those symptoms of dementia and atrophy of the brain, at least a general correlation. Would you agree with that, Joanna?
In people with dementia, I understand that there are signs of brain atrophy. In people with schizophrenia, people who've been on antipsychotics, there are some studies that show a correlation between brain shrinkage and increased levels of cognitive or intellectual impairment, and some studies that don't. It's a little bit more mixed, but I think the majority of studies suggest that yes, there might be some association between brain shrinkage and intellectual impairment of some sort. And do you want me to talk about the MRI studies quickly?
Yeah, well, you know, just for a minute or two, and then we can come back to it after break. And after break, you know, I'm talking with British psychiatrist Joanna Moncrief, and after the break I'm going to ask her to talk directly about her two books. Well, she's got three books at least, but about the myth of the chemical cure and more recently, The Bitterest Pill, which has a lot to do with what we're talking about today. But just for a minute or two, talk about more about these MRI studies.
Yeah, you pointed out, Peter, as I said, in the 1980s to start with, that there was evidence that people with schizophrenia had smaller brains and larger brain cavities. And that was always interpreted as being an effect of schizophrenia, whereas you were saying, no, this is the drug treatment. And then in the 1990s with MRI, it could be shown not only that people had smaller brains, but you could actually show the brains getting smaller over time if you repeated the scans. And first of all, that was again interpreted as being an effect of schizophrenia. And people thought, oh, hey, look, we've found what happens. We can show the brain shrinkage that occurs in people with early schizophrenia. And just recently, an MRI study was published which shows, you know, the strongest predictor of that brain shrinkage is the antipsychotic, the exposure to antipsychotic drugs. So you know, as I was saying, you were right all along. You were saying it in the 1980s. Very belatedly, people have started to admit this in the last, just in the last few years, because the long-term studies show this strong correlation between exposure to antipsychotic drugs and the amount of brain shrinkage that, that is detected on these MRI scans.
Well, today is turning out to be a real emphasis on, I think, core issues in psychiatry of involuntary treatment, social control, and the damaging effects of the antipsychotic drugs. My own research, which I summarize in Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, the first half of it, indicates that all the psychiatric drugs and probably all psychoactive substances of any strength produce chronicity of emotional instability and signs of brain injury in the form of cognitive difficulties, memory and concentration and focus and so on. Let's go to break, bring on the music, and we will be back with Joanna Moncrief. And this is Dr. Peter Breggin, my guest and treasured friend, Joanna Moncrief, who thinks about as deeply as one can think about the issues that we are mutually concerned about. She's the author of The Myth of the Chemical Cure and now The Bitterest Pill. She's an active member of the Critical Psychiatry Network in Great Britain and also a senior lecturer at the University College London. Joanna, hello again. How you doing
hello,
over there?
Peter. I'm fine, thank you. Still awake.
you're 5 hours later. I appreciate your – is this late for you? You've got three children, a family – is this
yes,
late
it's not
for
too
you?
Late, don't worry.
All right. Unless you have another place you'd like to start or someplace you'd like to contrast our opinions or to add something, which I'm very open to, I would be happy to have you just start to talk about the talk in terms of these two books, because I think that gives you a framework for a lot of the issues you're most interested in.
Yes, thank you, Peter. And I want to acknowledge your ideas again, because really what I feel I've done in these two books, starting with The Myth of the Chemical Cure, is to take your ideas and run with them, really. And you've always been very, very, very nice, you know, about the fact that I've taken your ideas. I think you put it so clearly, this issue that, that what we're doing when we use psychiatric drugs is we're altering the brain, we're changing the brain. In most cases, we're dampening down neurological function, emotions, thinking, and physical activity often as well. And what I've tried to do is contrast that idea, which I think is exactly what we're doing, with how psychiatrists have tried to present what they're doing, and they've tried to present it as if using psychiatric drug treatment is the same as using penicillin, as if it's sophisticated and targeted, as if it's targeting some underlying illness and reversing it or rectifying it in some way. And what I've been suggesting is really there's no evidence that any of the drugs we use in psychiatry, antipsychotics or antidepressants or mood stabilizers, are reversing any underlying chemical imbalance or other sort of abnormality. And that, you know, your original ideas that what these drugs were doing was dampening down neurological functioning is much more plausible. So in The Myth of the Chemical Cure, I looked at this idea across the board and looked at all the different sorts of psychiatric drugs. And in my recent book, The Bitterest Pills, I focused on antipsychotics, partly because of all this new research coming out that we were talking about earlier, and also partly because Because they're the sort of central focus of psychiatry. You know, this we were talking at the beginning of the program about psychiatry and social control, about one of its core functions still being the modification of behavior that society doesn't like. And the principal way that that is now done is by giving people antipsychotic drugs. So that's why I think they're such an important class of drug. And so my new book traces their history in quite a lot of detail, looks at the research studies that were supposed to establish their effectiveness, looks at the research studies on long-term treatment, looks at the evidence on tardive dyskinesia, and then looks at some of the newer research and some of the topical issues like the... it looks at the increased rates of prescribing, which I think is very frightening because, as we were saying earlier as well, you know, these drugs are, you know, have a lot of very damaging effects, and yet they're being used more and more frequently, and they seem to be given out to people with less and less severe problems. You know, they're being used for anxiety and depression more and more. They're being used for sleep disorders, for people with anger problems, and for the diagnosis of bipolar disorder, which has been stretched out to include lots more people than it used to. So that's what my latest book focuses on, and that's why I've chosen to focus it in that way.
One of the points that you made in the book, The Bitterest Pill, is that all studies of antipsychotic drugs are done on patients who have already been exposed to antipsychotic drugs. So it's not like we're showing or have any studies showing that if you're having your first psychotic break, these drugs are good for you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even the acute studies that are looking at treatment of an acute episode, most of those studies, most of the people in those studies have already been started on the drugs. And so the people being put in the placebo group are actually being taken off drug treatment to go on to the placebo. And long-term studies, it's even worse. So it's not the case that there's a group of untreated people or people who had very brief treatment and then were taken off. Most of the studies that are supposed to support the idea of long-term treatment, the benefits of long-term treatment, have compared a group of people who've been on antipsychotics, say, for sort of 10 or even 20 years, and they've compared them with a group of people who've also been on antipsychotics for 10 or 20 years, but then are suddenly taken off them and put on a placebo, on a sugar pill. And, of course, people who've been on a very... profoundly body and brain altering substance for that long are going to have withdrawal symptoms when they stop. The body is going to notice when you suddenly stop taking this powerful substance. And because they're such sedative drugs, you know, they sort of dampen and suppress the nervous system. When you stop taking them, people's nervous systems are going to become rather overactive and out of control, and people are going to get agitated and not sleep. And there's some evidence that stopping these drugs can even make people psychotic or give people psychotic symptoms that they didn't originally have. So you can even sometimes induce a psychotic episode by coming off the drugs. I mean, there are some case studies that have looked at people who've been on antipsychotics or antipsychotic-like drugs for other reasons, because they're very nauseous, for example. And then when the antipsychotics have been stopped, these people have developed a psychosis, even though they have no history of psychosis or schizophrenia. So it seems that sometimes coming off these drugs can precipitate a psychotic episode in itself, and it certainly also can make people agitated and uncomfortable. And the trouble is that all those withdrawal symptoms have been ignored in these studies. And when people have been getting worse and agitated and not sleeping, everyone's just said, oh, they're relapsing. And so the people in the placebo group who are having these withdrawal studies are thought to be having high rates of relapse, but actually many of them will probably simply be having the effects of withdrawal. Now, you can probably lessen those effects if the withdrawal is done very slowly and gradually. But you still need to be aware that there still might be some withdrawal effects. People still might have difficulty sleeping. People still do have difficulty sleeping if they cut down on antipsychotics like olanzapine. I know, I see it all the time. You know, these drugs do make people sleep a lot. So if you cut them down, you know, even by a small amount sometimes, people won't be able to sleep. So this is a really important point, and it's a point that I don't think I appreciated for a long time. You assume that if a study has established that a drug is effective, that what's happened is people have gone into the study and either taken the drug or taken the placebo, and have gone into the study without taking a drug and gone on to one of these options, but. As you point out, this is not the case. This is not how the studies have been done. And that's because antipsychotics were rolled out and were in very common use before proper controlled trials were set up. It had already been assumed that they were beneficial, and they were already being prescribed on a long-term basis. So it was already difficult to find people that hadn't had the drug started. But it's a real problem with the evidence base. I think it means that certainly as far as long-term treatment is concerned, we really, I think, don't know whether it's a good or a bad thing to be on these drugs long-term. My guess is that there are some people who do need them and do benefit from them for quite long periods, but there are certainly people who don't need them long-term and who would be better off without them. But even the treatment of an acute episode, the evidence is far from ideal, is far from perfect, because as I said, even those short-term studies of people who've gone into them have usually already been on treatment. So it's a really important issue that complicates the evidence we have and actually means that really. We don't know where we stand with these drugs.
Of course, I feel more strongly that we do know where we stand, that they're toxins. They ruin brain function ultimately. They're shortening lifespan, some studies indicating up to 20 years being lopped off people's lives on these drugs long term. I feel more strongly that that, in fact, they're just a disaster, that we do better without them, and that in a sane society they'd be illegal. So I do have a stronger opinion about it, but we're both thinking about it seriously, which matters. And as you pointed out, the profession just refuses to look at this because, I don't know that you said this, but because it threatens its very core, its very identity. It's like taking a hammer away from a carpenter, maybe even the nails, too.
Yeah.
And he didn't know what to do after that. He didn't know how to build without banging things together and sticking nails through them.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, treatment of schizophrenia, psychosis, you know, very severe mental disturbance, is the core activity of psychiatry. And the way that it is done at the moment is the use of antipsychotics. So if you start saying, actually, these drugs are dangerous, toxic, and possibly not nearly as good as you thought they were. As you say, that goes to the whole heart of the identity of the psychiatric profession and its role, its social role as well. If it doesn't have this sophisticated medical treatment for the most severe mental disorder, what else does it have? You know, I think this has been the problem all along. I think this is why psychiatrists have not wanted to confront the dangers that these drugs obviously pose. I mean, the story of tardive dyskinesia, which you know well, sums this all up. You know, George Crane back in the 60s had to really fight to, you know, establish that these drugs were causing this neurological problem. Other leading psychiatrists poo-pooed him. They said, no, it hardly ever happens. It's not really serious. And it's the schizophrenia anyway. It's not really the drugs. But, you know, it's now quite clear that it is the drugs, and it was pretty clear then too. But the profession just didn't want to face up to it. Psychiatrists did write about tardive dyskinesia, did warn the profession about tardive dyskinesia, but always never really gave it the level of publicity that you would think should be given to, you know, a side effect which is essentially brain damage.
Yes, it's such an important story. What folks may not realize is that at the time that George Crane, who was a psychiatrist in the state hospital system, was describing tardive dyskinesia, most of the patients in the state hospital system, some studies, almost everybody, had tardive dyskinesia. And yet the people working in the state hospitals, sometimes, or I'm sure alongside George Crane, were saying, no, there is no such thing. So the capacity for denial of damage in psychiatry is just mind-boggling. Otherwise, we wouldn't have shock treatment. We wouldn't have lobotomy, which still goes on in different places, a couple of places in the U.S., some places in Canada. Any lobotomy you know of going on in Great Britain right now, psychosurgery?
I think that it happens very occasionally. Yep.
Yeah, well, we've got a couple of very active programs in North America, in Canada, and maybe they're slowing down now, but also at the Mass General in the Harvard program in Boston.
Right.
It's you get to the more you get to the center of psychiatry, the more you get to horrible, damaging treatments and utter denial of them. You write also about the role of the drug companies in regard to the antipsychotic drugs. You have just a ton of information about that. You up to sharing a little bit of that?
Yes, absolutely. So, it's interesting because what happened with tardive dyskinesia really replayed over the last 20 years with the atypical antipsychotics. But this time it was the drug companies who were selling this story, promoting this story, that the weight gain that happens with some of the atypical antipsychotics, olanzapine and clozapine in particular, the drug companies were suggesting that this was, and the diabetes that people get as a consequence, the drug companies were suggesting that this was linked to schizophrenia, that people with schizophrenia had an inherent vulnerability towards getting diabetes. And they set up conferences to look at this, and journal supplements were published, you know, with lots of articles pondering on the possible links between schizophrenia and diabetes. I think this was, you know, I think most of the profession actually were well aware that this was a drug-induced effect. I mean, it was difficult to deny because although the older drugs make people put on weight, some of these newer drugs make people put on a lot of weight and often in quite a short period as well. So the drug companies were partly promoting this idea to doctors. They wanted to try and stop doctors worrying too much about the weight-inducing effects of some of these antipsychotics. And, of course, in the United States where you are, there were claims against this drug company by many people who developed diabetes and got weight and increased their weight enormously. And there were big settlements made. And it was shown during some of those claims, some documents were leaked, and it was shown that the drug company had tried to play down the weight-inducing effects of their drug, that they knew this drug made people put on weight, but they had tried to deflect attention away from this effect. So
we're
that's
talking,
one of the things
folks,
that drug
yeah,
companies have been doing recently.
We're not talking about just getting a little chubby, too. A lot of people with life-threatening and pathological obesity. And they did the same thing, of course, with diabetes. These drugs cause diabetes by, among other things, killing the insulin-producing cells on the Isle of Langerhans, on the pancreas. But the claims are out there, and the articles came out that schizophrenics get diabetes, not the drugs giving it to them.
The company that makes one of the drugs that causes this extreme weight gain and diabetes sponsored research to try and show that there was a link between schizophrenia and diabetes, published a very small study suggesting there might be, but then, of course, there was a subsequent study showing that there wasn't any link. And it sponsored conferences on schizophrenia and diabetes. People from the drug company went round to different hospitals doing talks on the links between schizophrenia and diabetes. I sat through one as a newly appointed consultant about 10 years ago, given by a representative from a company. So the company was, as with tardive dyskinesia, trying to blame schizophrenia for the effects of the drug. And as you say, there's diabetes, and the weight gain can be really massive with some of these new antipsychotic drugs. It's not just putting on a bit of weight. It really can be quite extreme.
One of the things that I'm really proud of in regard to the whole issue of tardive dyskinesia and these damaging effects, you may not know about, Joanna, that when I published my book on the brain-disabling effects of psychiatric drugs, came out in 1983, I gave the manuscript to one of the most famous producers on television, who did a one-hour documentary that used the manuscript and described the negative effects of tardive dyskinesia. And that publicity forced the FDA to do its reconsideration of tardive dyskinesia labels on the drugs, and to hold, hearings, and to greatly increase the warnings for TD in the labels for those drugs. And there's a complaint there about my having done that, not mentioning me by name, but all this publicity made us take a look at this. From Paul Lieber, who was the head of the drug division at the time at the FDA, and then saying, but when I looked into it, I was surprised at how little doctors knew. So we really got to expand these warnings. Lieber was not grateful, though. When I met him a number of years later at some other hearings, he said, I know who you are, and refused to shake hands with me. Mm-hmm. They're not happy about the effects of a critic. They're not happy. Joanna, we have 3 or 4 minutes left. Other thoughts that you have?
Well, you say they're not happy. We were talking on the phone yesterday, weren't we, about how, I mean, I think that's right, but I also think that, I think that there is a bit of a change of heart over antipsychotics and over drug treatment in general going on at the moment. I think the combination of these brain imaging studies showing the brain shrinkage and the massive overselling of antipsychotic drugs and all the, you know, fines that the FDA have levied against the big drug companies, I think these things have brought antipsychotic drugs and drugs for mental disorders in general into disrepute over the last few years. So I think there's a little bit of a change of attitude, both among the general public, who I think are more sceptical and more cautious now about some of these types of drugs that are being recommended for them, and also to some extent among the psychiatric profession. I mean, a few years ago, people completely believed, there was this myth around that schizophrenia was a progressive form of brain damage, and that if it wasn't treated quickly and early, people would get more and more and more brain damage. so that you had to treat people as early as possible and give them lots of medication to stop the brain damage. And there was no evidence for that belief. Well, the evidence was the brain shrinkage that now turns out to be caused by the antipsychotics, but there's no real other evidence for that belief. And, of course, it promoted the idea that, you know, we should be treating anyone who's got any sort of vague signs of mental disorder or psychosis, and we should be treating them really early and quite aggressively. And I think there's a pulling back from that idea. I think there's an acknowledgement now that actually there wasn't really evidence for that idea. And, of course, these brain imaging studies now are starting to implicate the antipsychotics rather than the disorder. So I think there is a bit of a change of heart going on, although it's probably not affecting practice substantially in any way at the moment. I don't know what it's like over in the United States. Would you agree?
I think that the public is having a definite shift, a dramatic shift, in being much more cynical, skeptical, and critical about the use of psychiatric drugs, and even being appalled by its being given to the elderly and given to children. I think there are some positive changes in the profession. I've been asked to do some things with a giant behavioral healthcare provider. So I think there are some changes in the profession. But psychiatry historically only responds to pressure. And I don't think that we're going to see a lot of change ever coming from within, because psychiatry historically hangs on to this whole mythology, as you pointed out, around so-called schizophrenia being a disease and being treatable only by psychiatrists. It's what Zoss called the sacred symbol of psychiatry, schizophrenia and its treatment. That's the justification for the whole ball of wax of psychiatry on a large social scale, including involuntary treatment. Joanna, we're coming to an end. My guest, Joanna Moncrief, her two recent books, great books, The Myth of the Chemical Cure and The Bitterest Pill. Thank you so, so much for being on my radio show.
Thank you, Peter. It was a pleasure.